From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, the weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Around 2010, the deep waters of Utah's Great Salt Lake contained high levels of toxic methylmercury. In fact, mercury measurements in waterfowl using the lake led to an advisory on human consumption of certain ducks.
But by 2015, 90% of the mercury was gone. According to a study performed by scientists at the University of Utah, Westminster College, and the Department of Natural Resources, the disappearance of this heavy metal was not due to aggressive environmental policies or a wide-ranging cleanup effort. Instead, it's part of a large-scale, unplanned chemistry experiment, which the lake itself performed.
That's right. Frank Black is an associate professor of chemistry at Westminster College and one of the researchers who participated in this study. He joins us in the first part of the show to discuss the mystery mercury of the Great Salt Lake.
And finally, oh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Keep going, Chris.
Thanks, Nell. Then in the second part of the show, Charlie Matthews joins us. Charlie was a longtime teacher of AP Physics at Park City High School and also helped start the PC CAPS program there. He has now set those activities aside to focus on STEM-related measures, programs, and advocacy. He joins us to discuss the latest on STEM in Utah.
And finally, Summit County just announced that they're joining a group called the County Climate Coalition. It's a group of counties around the country who are joining together in response to our administration's recent withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords. Aaron Bragg from Summit County Sustainability Office joins us to provide us some details on what the coalition is all about, why the council decided to sign on, and the Summit County Council's moving down the road of 100% renewable energy.
Now, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in studio is Frank Black. He's an associate professor of chemistry at Westminster College, and he was one of the members of a research team that recently looked at the levels of mercury in the Great Salt Lake, some of the impacts associated with that mercury, why it's there, but more importantly, some of the changes that mercury undergoes when it's in the lake and where it ends up in the lake. It's all kind of a little confusing. I'll let Frank explain. Frank, first of all, thanks for taking the time to join us this morning.
Yeah, no, we're always happy to talk about our research.
First of all, you work at Westminster College teaching chemistry?
Correct.
Okay. And you got involved in this research how?
So I've been doing mercury research for, I guess, more than a decade now. So my background is I'm a trace metal biogeochemist. So I study how trace metals cycle in the environment. And one that we've been interested in for a long time is mercury. And I came to Westminster 6 years ago. And when I did that, people in the previous 5 years had just started to learn that there was a big mercury problem in the Great Salt Lake. And so my starting research on mercury in the Great Salt Lake would just kind of made a lot of sense at that time.
Okay. So let's start here. Let's talk about how mercury gets into the Great Salt Lake, whether it's naturally there or it's introduced in some fashion. What are all the different sources of mercury?
Yep, it's all of the above. It's a combination. So Some of the mercury, and so this isn't something that, you know, we completely understand, but if we look at ecosystems elsewhere, some of it's going to come in with freshwater inputs. So whenever you flush your toilet, it's going to go down to a wastewater treatment plant. That's going to go into the lake, and that's going to take some mercury with it. There's going to be mercury that comes in with rivers. And then there's also, which is unique for heavy metals, mercury can be deposited from the atmosphere via atmospheric deposition. And so some of the mercury that's coming in via those different mechanisms is completely natural. It just comes from rocks that degrade and release mercury. But most of it at this point is going to be from anthropogenic sources. So whenever you burn coal or oil, that releases mercury to the environment. So for example, about 10 years ago, there was a study on the West Coast, and they decided that over half of the mercury that was atmospherically deposited in California originated in coal combustion in China. So
wow.
We have mercury that's coming from local sources, and we also have it coming from global sources. So mercury is a true global pollutant and an environmental problem that crosses international boundaries.
So what are some of those local sources that we're looking at here in Utah?
Yeah, so there used to be mercury in quite a few products. That includes things like old switches and your compact fluorescent bulbs. And so, you know, those get broken every once in a while. So that ends in a waste stream, and that's going to end up in the lake. Whenever you burn something, so that includes fossil fuels or mining, is going to release some mercury. Slightly more regional sources is just to the west of us. We have Nevada and California, where there's a lot of old gold and mercury mines that are releasing mercury to the atmosphere. And some of that passes over us, but some of it gets deposited. So there's a number of different places that mercury is going to come from.
So how does mercury end up in the atmosphere? How does that process take place?
So this is where it's useful to talk about how mercury exists in multiple forms in the environment. Mm-hmm. And so one of those is elemental mercury. So if you think of old mercury thermometers, that silver liquid inside, if you were to break one of those thermometers open and pour the mercury out onto a desk and wait a while, just like water, it's going to evaporate. And that volatility, the ability for it to go into the atmosphere, is what allows it to be transported anywhere in the world via the atmosphere and later be deposited.
Okay. And again, there's trace amounts of mercury, elemental mercury, in coal. So when we burn coal, that mercury kind of volatilizes, goes up the stack, out the stack, in a gaseous state. And then over a period of time, it can then resolidify or deposit, as you say, via precipitation.
Yeah, so once it's in the atmosphere, that elemental mercury can be deposited directly. And so that is what we would call dry deposition.
Mm.
Or you can get a chemical reaction that converts elemental mercury into inorganic mercury, or mercury 2+, which is an ion. And that really likes to bind to particles in the atmosphere or to dissolve in water. So if a rainstorm comes along, it's going to wash a lot of that inorganic mercury out. And so that would be wet deposition.
Okay. So dry and wet deposition. This is ends up in the Great Salt Lake. What happens to that mercury once it gets into the Great Salt Lake or any lake, water body?
There's lots of different places it can go from there. So some of it, mercury is really sticky and likes to bind to particles. So some of it's going to bind to particles and just sink to the bottom of the lake. Some of it can be taken up into the food chain. And one of the things that makes mercury unique is that it can be converted into an organic form called methylmercury. And methylmercury is what we might call the bad form, because while all forms of mercury are toxic, methylmercury is the only form that gets biomagnified up aquatic food chains, which means that every time you go up a trophic level, the concentration of mercury increases. And the result of that is that by the time you get to the top of the food chain and those big fish that we often like to eat, you can get mercury concentrations that are up to 10 million times higher than the water that they're swimming around in.
Wow.
And at that point, those mercury concentrations are high enough that they become a concern for wildlife and human health.
All right. So what was your research focused on?
We were trying to understand where mercury methylation occurs primarily. And in the Great Salt Lake, and if we look at the organisms around the lake, like the ducks and the brine flies and the brine shrimp, the mercury that we find in those is quite high compared to, say, if we go to Utah Lake or other areas nearby, and it's not clear where that mercury comes from. And so it's useful, you know, so I said that methylmercury is kind of the bad form of mercury. If we got rid of that, the environmental mercury problem would mostly go away.
Hmm.
And it turns out that the Great Salt Lake has some of the highest concentrations of methylmercury ever measured in any natural water body in the world.
Wow.
And those are found down in what's called the deep brine layer of the Great Salt Lake in the south arm. Okay, so this is where it kind of leads to the observation that the Great Salt Lake does not behave as one uniform, homogeneous lake. It's actually cut up into kind of four different compartments that behave very differently. So you have the railroad causeway that was built in 1959 that cuts from east to west. So that cuts the lake from north to south. So in the northwest, we have what we call the North Arm or Gunnison Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have very much freshwater input, so that's the saltiest part of the lake. So it's almost 10 times saltier than seawater. So to the south of that, you have what we call the South Arm or Gilbert Bay, and it's still really salty. It's around 15%. If you've ever been to Antelope Island, you drive on another causeway that cuts off Farmington Bay to the south. And so that gets a lot of freshwater inputs from the Jordan River as well as wastewater treatment plants. So it's a little bit fresher. It's closer to, you know, 5 to 10% salinity. And then in the northeast, you have the Bear River Bay area, which gets the largest freshwater inputs from the Bear River. So that's the only place where it's fresh enough water that we, you know, find fish typically. So.
All right. So different departments of the lake have different levels of mercury or different and in different forms?
So they have different salinities, and they also have different concentrations of mercury in some case. But where this comes in for our research is you have the north arm and the south arm that are separated, and the north arm is the saltier one. And you get a little bit of water that's able to go back and forth between the north arm and south arm under two culverts that are in the railroad causeway, at least until about 4 years ago. So until then, you could get water going back and forth. And when you have water that goes from the north arm, which is very salty, it's also denser. So when it flows into the south arm, it sinks down and it creates its own layer that we now call the deep brine layer.
Okay.
And because it just sits at the bottom, all of the oxygen has been used up by bacteria. So the same way when we break down food, we use oxygen. These bacteria do the same thing. And because that deep brine layer never mixes up to the atmosphere, you don't get new oxygen diffusing in. And so it's what we call anoxic, which just means there's no oxygen. And it turns out those low oxygen environments are where we get mercury methylation occurring by bacteria.
Okay. So now you have this methylmercury layer in the deep brine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what happened when those culverts were allowing water to go back and forth, say north to south? Those culverts were closed off?
Yeah. So in late 2012 and then again in late 2013, the railroad decided that there were structural integrity problems with the culverts, and to avoid, you know, them collapsing and potential derailment, which obviously we don't want, they got permission from the state to close those culverts, which means that you cut off the vast majority of flow of water from the south arm and north arm. And so when you cut off that north arm water flowing in and constantly replenishing that deep brine layer, eventually that deep brine layer slowly mixed up into the rest of the water column in the south arm, and the deep brine layer eventually disappeared after about a year and a half to 2 years after closing the culverts.
And the mercury levels too?
Yep, and so that's where our research comes in. So this was this great experiment that, you know, we weren't able to control, but if you have this idea that maybe all of the mercury in the organisms around the lake is tied back to this deep brine layer and the methylmercury production there, you could start to hypothesize, well, if we get rid of the deep brine layer, we might expect methylmercury concentrations to go down in the water, and then we'd also expect it to go down in all the organisms.
Right.
And so that's kind of what we were testing.
Okay.
So interestingly, around the same time it was discovered that there was really high levels of methylmercury in the lake, there was also concern about the waterfowl seeing really high levels. And so it was thought that somehow there was a connection between that deep brine layer and these birds. But it sounds like that's, you know, up in the air. What happened with that?
Yep, and so that's something that people had hypothesized for a long time, but tracking exactly where that methylmercury comes from in a particular duck is really difficult to do. So it could be coming from the deep brine layer, it could be getting produced in sediments just other parts in the lake, and then wetlands are also hotspots for methylmercury production, and the entire eastern shore of the Great Salt Lake has lots of wetlands. And so we kind of use this as an opportunity to say, well, if the deep brine layer disappears and that's where most of the action is at, we'd expect mercury concentrations to go down in the water and to eventually go down in these organisms. And it turns out that the mercury concentrations in the water column and in the sediments, those did go way down. So we saw about 80% reduction in methylmercury concentrations in the water column and in the deep sediments and the sediments underneath the lake when the deep brine layer went away. Hmm. But what we didn't see was any decrease in the mercury concentrations in brine flies or in the duck species that we were measuring. So it seems like maybe there's not a direct connection between the deep brine layer and some of the organisms, and that's a bit of an open question. So the railroad, when they closed the culverts, the state said, well, you know, we need some water flow from the north arm to south arm because that could affect the salinity in both, and that can affect things like the brine shrimp industry and also the brine flies and brine shrimp that are important food for all of the millions of migratory birds that come in. So they said, well, okay, you have to come up with some way to recreate some of that flow. And so they built a bridge that they opened up in December. And we think that just now, in the last month or so, we're finally getting flow from the north arm back to the south arm. So we're expecting the deep brine layer to reform. And so our research is ongoing to say, well, when the deep brine layer comes back, what happens to the mercury concentrations? But what we saw when the deep brine layer went away, we didn't see a big decrease in the mercury concentrations in the ducks or in the brine flies. Mm. So that suggests there's probably more sources of methylmercury out there that play an important role in mercury cycling in the lake than what people might have initially expected.
I'm sorry, we're speaking with Frank Black, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Westminster College. He and along with some colleagues at the University of Utah and the Utah Department of Natural Resources are doing some research on the Great Salt Lake with respect to mercury concentrations and its movement and biochemistry, et cetera. We've got a couple more minutes.
Yeah. So what are the implications of this, you know, these high levels of methylmercury in the deep brine layer for people? Is this something that we need to be concerned about? How does it impact us? What should we do about it?
Sure. So there are two parts to that, I think. So one is what are mercury's impacts on humans? And so typically when we think about mercury in the environment, the concern ultimately comes to the consumption of fish because that's the main pathway for mercury exposure to humans. And so all 50 states in the U.S. have fish consumption advisories due to high mercury, and Utah does
all
in a number 50,
of... I'm sorry, all 50 states in one form or another.
Oh, yeah.
It's a
pretty large percentage of both freshwater lakes as well as coastal environments. And off the top of my head, I won't get the numbers right, but for example, I think somewhere around 25% of all coastal areas have fish consumption advisories for mercury.
And fish and shellfish, which also bioaccumulate.
In some cases, yeah, they're pretty low on the food chain and they're filter feeders, so they end up with high concentrations of things like PCBs. They don't necessarily end up with high concentrations of mercury.
Oh, well, okay.
Sounds like a fair trade-off.
But the point is, it's ubiquitous at this point.
Yes,
in
absolutely.
Our water cycle and now in our ecosystems,
yep.
Plants and animals.
Yep.
Okay.
So I will jump
that.
In. Yeah, so one ahead. Thing I think that's worth mentioning about fish consumption advisories is these advisories are never telling people no one should eat any of the fish.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of great health benefits of eating fish. They're high in omega-3 fatty acids. In many places, it's a great source of protein. So instead, these advisories are really saying, women and children who are the most susceptible, because mercury is a neurotoxin, so it disproportionately affects developing neurological systems. So women who are thinking of becoming pregnant or young children, it's still good to eat fish, but avoid the fish that have the highest mercury concentration. Mm-hmm. So things like swordfish or certain types of tuna. Or shark.
Apex or fish at the top of the food chain.
Exactly. Okay. So in Utah freshwater lakes, that would be things like bass, some types of trout, those come up. The Great Salt Lake, except for up in the Bear River, we don't have fish because it's way too salty.
Yeah.
But instead, we're the only place in the world that I know of that has duck consumption advisories due to very high levels of mercury. And duck hunting is quite popular along
Absolutely.
The eastern shores. And so for the Great Salt Lake, that's the main concern for public health.
Okay.
So getting back to your question now, what do we do about that? Ultimately, the reason we study mercury in the Great Salt Lake is if we can understand how mercury is cycling, we might be able to come up with management strategies that would allow us to lower mercury concentrations in the ducks and the methylmercury concentrations in the water. And ultimately, that's the goal of our research and the funding that the state does towards this.
All right. We got to wrap up. Where do people go to read the paper itself? Is it available?
It is. So, the most recent research was published in a journal called Environmental Science and Technology.
Yeah.
However, if you don't have a subscription to that, which is quite pricey, you could email myself or Bill Johnson at the University of Utah, who's to collaborate on this, and we'd be happy to send you a copy of it.
All right. And like you say, this research continues.
Yep. So I have a number of undergrads at Westminster who work with me, and we're also working with Bill Johnson and some of his grad students at the University of Utah, as well as Brian Rowland and some other people at the USGS. So we're continuing this research through the coming year as this new bridge was just opened this past December, and we are expecting the deep brine layer to reform kind of as we speak.
All right. And
breaking news.
That's right. And here's some breaking news, too. If all of us want to help this matter, we use less electricity. The fewer kilowatt hours we consume, the less coal we burn, the less mercury gets introduced to the atmosphere. It's all linked
together.
It's
all connected.
I know. Turn your lights off and help save some ducks, reduce the levels of mercury in ducks.
Live in the dark, like Chris.
I'm doing my part to help the ducks. Frank Black, again, he's Associate Professor of Chemistry at Westminster College. And thanks so much for joining us this morning on this screen.
Thanks for having us in.
All right. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters and sponsors, and we come back. Charlie Matthews, physics teacher at Park City High School, now working in STEM, joins us to talk about what he's been doing recently. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Steve here from Kumbaya Kitchens and Rhode Island Diner, longtime listener and supporter of KPCW. Since 1997, we've been providing catering service to the Park City community for formal and non-formal events. At the Rhode Island Diner in Oakley, we are now open Wednesday through Sunday. KumbayaKitchens.com or eat@RhodeIslandDiner.com.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the studio for the second part of the show is Charlie Matthews. Charlie, we all know around town, is a physics teacher at Park City High School, AP Physics, among other things. He's kind of turned his attention from that arena to focus on STEM coordination and working with adults on STEM education, et cetera, and he's here to talk about that and some of the work he's doing at the Great Salt Lake or so. Right, Charlie?
Yes. So let me start by just saying I'm a former classroom teacher.
Right.
And now STEM coordinator, which science, technology, engineering, math. But right now the focus has been primarily in science, but with the idea that really all of those work together. And so using the science classroom to bring in engineering, applied math, using technology appropriately. But one of the things I wanted to say that brought me into this role of STEM coordinator is for years being a college physics, AP physics teacher, is kind of the top of the pecking order of, you know, kids that are very focused. Most of them already are looking towards careers in science. And what was unfortunate in that role is that I saw the vast majority of kids not even considering taking a class like that. Oh, that's too hard. I can't do that. And my goal as a STEM coordinator is to work with teachers in our programs in Park City so that starting with the kindergartners all the way on up through, we can begin a process so that hopefully these kids, by the time they are in high school, can be those young scientists that say, hey, I can do this.
So elementary school teachers, all teachers.
That's the plan, and right now the focus is middle school. The state of Utah rewrote science standards. There's a bigger picture story with all this that starting with the National Science Foundation, some other think tank groups back in the early 2000s posed a question. And the question was, why are fewer and fewer kids going into science-related areas, and specifically they were looking at minority groups and women. And that was the premise that brought them together, but within a short time frame, they realized there's a bigger, more fundamental problem, and that's how science is taught in the United States and really worldwide, that so many kids learn about science, they learn a history of science. But science is a process. It's you know, going out there asking a question of something you can't figure out, and then using tools, using processes to try to find answers to those questions. And they quickly realized that's the missing link that, from science education. So a document came out in 2013. It's now called the Next Gen Science Standards. And big states like New York, California, Ohio, and Oregon have bought in totally and have just said K through 12, we're going to take these standards. That's going to be our framework. Here in Utah, it's been a little more piecemeal. Right now, it's 6 through 8, and we're based on that.
So is this a new role for the Park City School District STEM coordinator?
Yes, and in fact, my funding for my paycheck and feeds my family actually is through a very gracious Ed Foundation grant.
Interesting. And so is this a precedent that you're seeing maybe in some of these bigger states with a STEM coordinator for the school district? Do you see this elsewhere in Utah, or is this a kind of unique situation?
Well, that's a great question, Neil. What has been really impressive that I've seen in Utah, there has in the big school districts, and Utah has some of the biggest in the country, and it's typically to make cost minimized so you can hire a science coordinator if you have 4,000 students in your district.
Sure.
Well, we're 4,000. I mean, if you have 40,000, 50,000, 60,000.
Mm-hmm.
What's been neat is these traditional science coordinators have now moved into this role of STEM. And what's the most exciting part about this is some of our biggest school districts, Davis, Salt Lake, Granite, these folks have taken on a real grassroots movement that I'm a part of to say, look, the state of Utah has kind of with fits and starts moved towards this new type of science. But big shock, we're the lowest funded state in the country. And in the area of science, it's no different. There's talk of moving this direction, but there hasn't been, from the state end, a lot of financial support and personnel support. So from this grassroots level, many of us in these individual school districts have gotten together and said, look, we need to develop curriculum that's going to be authentic and get these kids excited about science. And just last week, I was developing some curriculum from my physics-chemistry background that I'm sharing with Salt Lake. And their science coordinator, who's a geologist, has developed a whole phenomena-based study around the Rio Tinto Kennecott mine and the fallout from that, both positive and negative. And so she's sharing that curriculum with me, and I'm sharing the physics-based curriculum with her. So it's been really a win-win.
Speaking with Charlie Matthews, he is STEM coordinator for Park City School District. We're talking about some of the work he's doing. So I am a middle school science teacher, math teacher. I go to, I guess, a forum or so, an event, workshop with you. What am I going to learn from you?
Well, let me back off a little bit. Let's put all ourselves back in a situation where you were either in a classroom or you're in a conference as adults. And how is information typically disseminated? There's somebody up front. There may be a PowerPoint, but it's typically one person who's talking and the rest of the audience is receiving. Mm-hmm. And there's a very pragmatic reason for that. If anybody out there who's ever had to do this type of presenting, it's a little scary if you don't have control of the audience. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can really have control of the audience is to be what the old saying is, the old sage on the stage. This type of science teaching is fundamentally and radically different. What it requires is to pose questions for kids to try to find answers to. That means in that classroom, instead of those kids sitting in nice, neat rows, they're going to be carrying on investigations that aren't cookbook. You know, do this step first, do this step second. It's going to be much looser, but still requiring the guidance, proper guidance of the instructor. It's a big, big challenge. So a lot of the challenge for me is to work with our incredible school teachers, science teachers here in Park City, to begin to create a comfort with discomfort, because it is a changing role of the instructor. It's a changing environment for the classroom.
Okay.
And I would imagine that in a lot of cases that takes a little bit more supervision. You can't have 32 kids in a classroom, or you can't take, you know, maybe a big class size and then take them out to the field with one teacher. You know, you have to have probably more leadership and oversight.
Yeah, there's a couple of things going on there. One is the, you know, the pragmatic, if you have kids working in teams on whatever the problem is, the phenomena that they're studying, making sure that they're safe,
sure,
making sure they're staying on task. Uh-huh. But the bigger one is being, and this is where there's the real skill set as the instructor, are the kids moving forward and in trying to solve this problem? And moving forward sometimes is a little more subtle. They may be going down a different path initially, but do you really want to just harness them back in and make them go a particular direction? Because the people who made these discoveries originally were out in the desert many times, mm-hmm. wandering around and sometimes developing new questions. So the biggest challenge, I think, for the instructor is going to be that subtle, when do I prompt these groups of kids with specific questions that bring them back on task? Mm-hmm. Do I see the direction of the class moving in a good direction here? When is the time for absolute direct instruction? Because that will never disappear. There are times when the teacher needs to stand in front of the kids and say, you need to do this, this, and this. So I think the biggest challenge is not going to be the strict classroom management, because we have phenomenal teachers here that know how to manage kids. And even when they're working in teams doing things and it seems as though maybe there's a little chaos, we have a very skilled teacher here in Park City that has the ability to manage mm-hmm. that. It's more that subtle, mm-hmm. How do you give the kids autonomy, but make sure that there is that forward progress mm-hmm. Taking place in the class.
I heard you mention on the way in, as we were transitioning from Frank Black, you were sitting there, you say you're going to be doing some field work related
in fact, tomorrow I'm going to be with our sixth grade science teachers up at Antelope Island. And I have been in collaboration with the Great Salt Lake Institute, which is run out of Westminster. And so I'm sure Frank knows all those folks there intimately well. It initially developed, I was talking about collaborative work that we're doing at the grassroots with different school districts. A woman by the name of April Mitchell, who is with Salt Lake District, had begun to develop a phenomena-based situation with Great Salt Lake that kids in sixth grade could investigate. Namely, what happens with the color of the lake? and satellite photos, you know, different times. You know, springtime, it's nice. It has this almost iridescent green color in the South Basin, this pink color in the North. Right now, I was just out there last week. It looks like the Caribbean in Great Salt Lake, because our little brine shrimp have been chomping away on the algae all summer. But it sets a phenomena for kids to investigate. Why is it like that? So that set the stage for me to get involved, and I've learned quite a few of the different tests that are done on the water, the environment up there. So I'm going to facilitate a training with our teachers, and we're together as a team going to come up what would be a good phenomena for our sixth grade students in Park City to investigate. We have a tentative plan right now of taking every sixth grade student in Park City over a 4-day period up to Antelope Island the fourth week in September and have them actually conducting the field study, which then once they learn these techniques of how do you find percent oxygen in the water, how do you find the percent salinity, what are some of the observational things you look for when you're out there, and how do you find turbidity, how cloudy the water is, what does that mean? As they do those field experiences, where a lot of that will be, you need to do this, this, and this, but then they make observations, they learn the equipment. Once they understand that, then they can come back to the classroom, look at studies that have been done, and understand when it describes a particular technique and these numbers, they'll understand what that means so that they can examine a phenomena. And it might be watercolor. Another great one to do right now is Great Salt Lake. It's slightly debatable right now, but in 2015, and it's about where it was in 2015 right now, is potentially the lowest level in recorded history. Well, salinity is increasing. What's that going to do to the ecosystem? Mm-hmm. So a phenomena could be studied in the classroom by creating different salinities of solutions of water, then putting algal spores in the water and brine shrimp cysts at different salinities and see how our producers and our primary consumers, how well they do in the water. So the kids actually get to conduct original research based on a real-world phenomena that's occurring right now in Great Salt Lake.
And they get to write a report, and then they submit it to Frank Black at Westminster College.
There we go, and hopefully get written up. But the biggest thing is they have learned what scientists do, and the hope is that not only do they have the tools, but they have the excitement to pursue a STEM career in the future.
That's fantastic.
And change our world.
And change
our
world. That's kind of stuff I did in graduate school. But seriously, that's the level of effort that you're trying to undertake here, and trying to impose enthusiasm. I guess.
And it's a long-term project. It's going to be one of these things that this paradigm shift in science. It's probably going to be a decade or so of a lot of commitment from a lot of people and a lot of institutions to see if we have an overall systemic change in our kids and what happens in the world of science, environmental, and ultimately awareness when they're in the voting booth.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Charlie, that's a good point, very good point. Charlie Matthews is STEM coordinator with Park City School District. Charlie, thanks again so much for taking time. Be interested to see what your findings are of the work you do at the Great Salt Lake starting tomorrow.
Sixth grade.
Well, have fun down there. Good luck.
Great talking with you guys.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Charlie.
Let's take a quick break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, Aaron Bragg from Summit County joins us.
That's right. We'll be talking about Summit County's new goals in relation to carbon.
All right. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us in the studio for the last part of the show here is Aaron Bragg, the Sustainability Specialist with Summit County. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Nell.
Well, there is some exciting news from the county. The county, it seems, has been focusing a lot on carbon and sustainability over the past few months. I think it kind of started with the Summit County Climate joining the Climate Coalition. So tell us a little bit about what that is and the reasons for that.
So the County Climate Coalition, little tongue twister.
It's a tongue twister.
Yes. Was started in Santa Clara, California, as Trump was looking to, with the intent to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord in June. They saw this as an opportunity to reaffirm their local goals. And since then, on June 21st, Summit County actually did confirm those as well, saying that in their resolution that they passed that climate change is a scientific consensus and it has human influences, and that we, in July of 2015, created our climate action plan. We're already working towards these things, and they just wanted to reaffirm their commitment to reducing global climate emissions.
So it's kind of a response to the administration's dropping out of the Paris Climate Accords that these counties, and you say it started with Santa Clara County in California.
Yes.
Saying that we're moving forward.
Yes.
We don't care if the administration doesn't care about these climate accords or doesn't care about carbon reduction. We're moving forward. And they've invited other counties to
Correct.
Join in. And Summit County
Yes.
just announced their.
Exactly.
So what does it mean you have to set new goals or objectives?
Not at this point. Okay. There's no financial requirement. It's just recommitting ourselves, making it public, joining this group, which will hopefully allow us to then have a larger collective voice.
Okay.
So how many counties have joined at this point?
That I
mean, very roughly.
Roughly, I'm thinking 13.
Okay, so it's still pretty small.
Yeah, very small, early in the process, so exactly.
Okay. And then more recently, Summit County has kind of been talking about setting a net zero carbon goal. So tell us where we stand in that process.
We are in the process of drafting that resolution, and it is on the agenda for next Wednesday, August 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
It will be an approval of a resolution, so it's sort of an administrative process. There's not necessarily going to be public comment taken
mm-hmm.
unless council decides to open that up. Otherwise, it'll just be administrative.
Okay.
But that's to announce that you're going to set some goals and standards to reduce carbon, the county's carbon footprint in some form?
Correct. The community-wide carbon footprint. Right now, about 30% of all of our greenhouse gas emissions for that footprint is fossil fuel-based electricity. So if we move forward on a net 100% renewable electricity for county-wide, that would be a great reduction in our greenhouse gas footprint. And I think it's a good step at this point in time because Park City, Moab, and Salt Lake City have already made those commitments and are beginning negotiations with Rocky Mountain Power. Power is in numbers.
So the goal to go 100% renewable, how would that happen? Like, is there discussion about like a municipal utility, kind of that huge step? Is it conversations with the current utilities about how to transition? What does that look like?
Right now it is conversations with the current utility, but it's looking at all options and making sure it's the best option, right? We don't want to put solar in our backyard just so we can show it off. If it's not going to make sense, then we don't want to move that way. We want to move in a way that's going to be beneficial for our entire community.
So that's reductions in electricity, like you say, but also efforts to reduce our natural gas consumption, and of course efforts to reduce consumption of oil in the form of gas, diesel, etc. They're all in play.
Correct.
And
yeah.
And while we're at it, as we've always reduce our consumption of water or our waste of water, because that requires a lot of energy in this county to move water around, to treat it and move it around. So water conservation equals energy conservation.
Correct.
Okay. So they're all in, it's like you say,
it's all tied together.
It's all tied together. All right. So we got a couple more minutes. Hey, you guys were at the film last week, were you?
Yes, we were.
We were indeed.
And were you on the panel?
Yes.
Okay.
I got to sit right next to Nell.
All right. Any
up in front of the crowd.
And the film from the Ashes?
Correct. Mm-hmm. National Geographic.
Okay. What was the takeaway from just a quick takeaway from the film or the panel?
So from the film itself focused really on the production of coal, like how are we getting this coal? And that's a picture that we don't see in too much depth, I think, too frequently. And that was pretty impactful. I think you see the communities that are impacted by this, both the people that have been mining coal their whole lives and the communities that have lost that industry.
Right.
The panel discussion really focused kind of on sustainability and some of these goals at Summit County and Park City are taking and how to get there.
And another member of the panel talked about a potential kind of rivalry between the U and BYU that might be coming up this fall in terms of reducing carbon.
Oh, okay.
A student-led initiative. Yeah. So Colin Green was there talking about that.
Competition, always a good way to spur conservation in that sense. Okay. Anything else you want to add? What's going on with the county? The county's doing a lot of things. You say
we're doing a lot
August
of things.
August 23rd is when that resolution gets
announced. Yeah, and in the press release about the County Climate Coalition that came out, it did mention a reduction in vehicle miles traveled that we're looking at, 5% reduction around the county by 2027, and that came directly out of the Transportation Department staff goal. So even though we have a sustainability office there, everybody, all different departments are always looking at ways that they can help move that needle.
All right, 5%.
It's the way to do it across the board.
Let's shoot for 11. Okay, 5%. Let's make it double digits. Is that hard?
I think we can just change that right now on the air.
I just did. Yeah, all right.
Done.
Aaron, thanks so much. Hey, if people want to go and learn more, can you go to the county website and learn more about this?
Yes. The packet for next week should be up by Friday, and if not, definitely on Monday.
Fantastic. We'll keep an eye out.
All right. Aaron Bragg with Summit County Sustainability Department. Thanks so much for joining us, sharing us with that information. We'll stay posted for additional info on the county's carbon reduction efforts.
Yes.
Let's take a break for one last round of sponsors.
That's right. We come back.
We got a news item or two we want to squeeze in. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
All right. Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And we got a news item or two and a calendar of events information to pass on. Let's start with that.
Yeah. So we have two events two Swanner Preserve and Eco Center events, both this Thursday. That should be a good time. So the first one that I'll mention is a trivia night, kind of happy hour thing at the Patagonia store here on Main Street. Earlier this morning, we heard Caroline Wara on Leslie's show talking about theirs, which is coming up 2 weeks after ours as well. And essentially, we'll be at the Patagonia store starting at 5:30 for 2 hours.
Okay.
And we will be there with information about Swanner. We'll have kind of four stations where you can learn fun facts, figures, and information about the preserve, local wildlife, the watershed here, all the kinds of issues that we work on at Swanner. And then there will be trivia questions that relate to those and prizes for those who do well. It's not like your classic sit-down trivia where you have to arrive with a team and you have to be there for the whole time. It'll be a little bit more laid back, and we'll have a few rounds of trivia. So,
it's trivia about what you learned about Swan.
Yeah. But, Chris, you have a pretty good working knowledge. You might be able to just show up and
Any questions on mercury?
Give it your best.
I'm gonna nail that.
I can't release that information on the air. So that should be a fun night. A bunch of the Swanner staff will be there hanging out, 5:30. And then for $10, you will get a Swanner and Patagonia pint glass and a beer, or a couple. And so it's a trivia night and happy hour there. If you are interested
Thursday,
in coming,
5:30.
However,
okay.
You must get in touch with us at Swanner Eco Center first so we can have you on our guest list. This is open to all of our members and constituents. And you can email peregrine.bosler@usu.edu.
Really? Okay.
And you can also call our main line and we'll make sure you're on the
what
list.
What if I wander in because I want to buy, you know, a Patagonia jacket?
Because there's alcohol, it's a private event, and so we can't just have people wander in unfortunately off the street and get a beer. But we're grateful for Patagonia to host this event.
All right, that's this Thursday starting at 5:30.
Yep. And also this Thursday at Swanner we have a wetland pond walk in the evening at 6:30 p.m. Out on the nature reserve.
I have to choose one or the other.
You have to choose it. Or you can come to the very beginning of the event at Patagonia.
6:30.
The Wetland Pond Walk you also need to register for. And this will be a walk out into the heart of the wetlands on the south side of the preserve. You'll get to see the fen and some of the spring-fed ponds. You'll get to learn about the Columbia spotted frog and tiger salamanders and some of the other amphibians we've got. And it's a really unique, really fragile area, so we don't get out there a lot with groups. So this is a neat opportunity to get out there. There aren't trails. It's not open to the public because of the conservation easements on it. And so this is something we offer a few times a year. People
all right.
Out.
May see a feral cat or two.
Oh,
who knows?
Hopefully not.
All right. Okay. But that's this also this Thursday, 6:30. But again, I have to contact somebody.
Yep. If you go to our website, you can register for this one right online.
All right. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. We got 2 minutes. Public comment period for the National Monuments. Department of Interior held a public comment period back in April and May, June. They extended it to July. They got over 1 million comments. Here's something I just read in, and I got less than a minute, Utah Adventure Journal. We may have to talk about this again next week. Basically, the DOI did something reprehensible. Surprise. They took comments that came from form letters. So if you had to fill out a form letter with, say, the Environmental Defense Fund, or you went to the Sierra Club website and they had a form letter that you can click on and add your name to, when all of those form letters got uploaded by those different groups, they count as one comment. That's it. So tens of thousands of comments from people who've sent in form letters.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting
or some of them are not form letters, right? You have the opportunity to change these and make your own comments.
Yeah.
But regardless, you're putting your name on this.
And on these
all
form
these individual
they
names.
They now are being considered as one comment. It's undemocratic, at least reprehensible.
And is different from, I assume, the precedent that's been set in the past. This is how these groups do this. They're able to collect it and then submit it all together.
All right. So over a million comments received. All these comments are being discounted or condensed to one single comment. That's why now when I reminded people is that you got to submit a personalized comment to doi.gov. The comment period's closed now, but that's what they're doing, and that's what they're evaluating. Expect more surprises coming up. We'll cover that.
And a good lesson moving forward as we submit our comments. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
We got to wrap up. Thanks to our sponsors and underwriters, who include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and listeners like you.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. Remember, we've got your watch.